Hi, today's March 4th, 2018. This is Mobile Views Podcast 244. I'm Todd Ogasa Ward, my good friend John Westfall. And as is often the case, we have a bunch of random stuff we're going to talk about. No theme, no big news. I mean, I'm sure there's big news, but nothing we cared about.
We're increasingly caring about less and less. It's,
I know. And we care more and more about less and less.
And today, I'll guarantee that this will be an interesting podcast because as we were discussing these notes beforehand, Todd and I disagreed on 2 points.
Oh, yeah.
On like a 5-point rundown. So this is going to be, this could be fireworks. This could be exciting. It probably
dueling ranting.
Yeah, exactly.
Dueling rants. Okay, the first one, probably not going to rant from either of us. 9to5 Google reports that there are longer upgrade cycles and growing purchases of used smartphones that threatened flagship sales. They found that back in 2014, the average upgrade cycle for a smartphone was 23 months, which makes sense, right? About 2 years when you're back then, when we had subsidized phones ran out. But now that number has hit 31 months, which is creeping up into the three-year range with 36 months. And I think it's because, one, we don't have subsidized phones anymore. And even if you do split it into monthly fees, people still think, man, this is a $1,000 phone.
Yeah.
You know?
It's an amazing thing. I had a love-hate relationship with the subsidies because back in the era when you and I were very big into Pocket PC, I had T-Mobile, and none of the good devices came to T-Mobile.
That's true.
So I would end up buying a lot of full-priced phones on AT&T and unlocking them and using them on T-Mobile. And it would be very frustrating when I go to resell those phones that within the United States you didn't get as good a price for them because people sort of didn't assume they had as much value because they could go out and get them from a subsidy, with subsidy from a carrier. So it sort of annoyed me at that point. I remember thinking, I wish everyone understood that the devices that they sort of take for granted every day are actually $1,000 devices. And now everyone understands that very well, but unfortunately I'm in the same boat as I always was where I'm buying, you know, for a while there I actually got to take advantage of subsidies and now I'm out of luck.
So. Yeah. Yeah, I was also on T-Mobile at the time. Yeah, but fortunately the few phones that T-Mobile had were the ones I wanted. So I really didn't feel too badly. You know, a lot of the HTC stuff is on T-Mobile, as you might recall.
Yeah.
And so I would tend to buy the new HTC phones as they came out. And there were some good ones. You know, I thought there were some pretty good ones. At least I was pretty happy with them. Even the touchless, oh gosh, the Dash. The HTC Dash.
Remember Dash it was a good device.
Right? Kind of a BlackBerry clone at the time. Which I liked very much, except I wish it had a touchscreen.
Yeah, the ones that I had the most complaints about were the Pantech Duo and the Pantech Matrix. Those were the two dual sliders. Those only came out on AT&T in the U.S., singular on one, AT&T on the other, because it was right around the changeover. Yeah. And some of the HP iPads only came out on AT&T. The iPad Mobile Messengers only came out on AT&T. So those were devices I was very interested in, and I still actually have two out of the three that I just mentioned sitting around over here because they were ones that I liked enough to keep. The other one that I remember when the Palm Trio with Windows Mobile came
out? Yes, I do remember that.
That was only on, I think, Verizon and might have just been Verizon because I remember I had a Vodafone branded one that I used for a while on T-Mobile.
Maybe
it also came out on AT&T. I don't remember exactly.
Yeah, you know, and people may not remember Windows Mobile smartphones were pretty popular back in the day. I think they had like 20-something percent of the market of smartphones, which is admittedly very small back then. You know, we're not talking about the hundreds of millions of phones sold today, but still, it was a thing. You know, it had about the same market share as I think Apple iPhones have today, which may be shocking to some, although not the numbers, which is why it died out. On the other hand, you know, some very popular phones from back then, the winners, BlackBerry gone, right? Nokia essentially gone. So even the winners back then, the huge market share people are no longer with us. It was a complete 100% turnover to iOS and Android. Which reminds me, you know, with this 31-month cycle, Android only upgrades, I think, 18 to 24 months after you buy something. Not after you buy something. After its release. So if there is a 31-month cycle and getting longer, for smartphone refreshes, it means that the Android fragmentation should continue to grow and not shrink. Mm-hmm. As Google basically stops upgrading you after, you know, 24 months after phone is released. And not everybody buys a phone right when it's released, so you will probably be, well, at the very least 12, but about, say, 12 to 18 months without an upgrade cycle. I was going to say security, but they may be releasing security patches. Though I have not seen a security patch for my Nexus 6 in probably over a year. Mm. So, yeah. Which I don't use as a phone, but, you know, I still keep powered up and on Wi-Fi. And if there's an upgrade, it should get one, but it hasn't. All right, the next one is something I've not tried. I just read about in The Verge. And apparently Google launched a browser-based sequencer for making music. So, have you tried it?
I heard about this, too. My problem is I don't use Chrome. So I haven't been able to...
Really?
It's not been... Yeah, I don't use Chrome on any device, so...
Wow. Now, that's interesting. Now, I think you may explain that once, but why don't you... Because too resource-hoggy?
Too resource-hoggy. I like Firefox on Windows.
Yeah?
Works and well. Safari on my Mac. And that's kind of just what I've done for a while now and been happy with it, so...
And I have to say, I've been using Firefox more, mostly because of speed. It's way faster than Chrome and Safari on the Mac. And, of course, Edge on the Windows is just a joke, so... something I'm going to try. I still use Chrome, so I'll try it one of these days. And for those who don't know what a sequencer is, basically it is a tool, like a multi-track recording tool, to let you... create sequences of notes and then layer them on other sequences of notes so you can build up an entire, you know, song or musical piece or whatever. Another Google item that I have not tried, and I don't even know if I have, is apparently it's in beta and only some people have it. It's only available in the beta for mobile. So I looked at my Android thing, but I didn't even know where to find it in YouTube or if I needed to download YouTube Creator. But Google Research published something called Mobile Real-Time Video Segmentation, which translates to having green screen video effects without a green screen, which is incredibly cool. It means you can shoot, and in real time, again, real time. So you can be shooting a video and replace the background behind you as you shoot, which is kind of amazing, I think.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in action yet. If it works, it will be really, really amazing.
Yeah.
In theory, it's amazing, but I want to see it in practice.
Yeah, there's amazing. There's a sample videos on the Google, some GIF. I can't have a hard time saying GIF. GIF. I know the creator of GIF says it's GIF, so I'll say GIF. But the GIF clips on the website that describes this mobile real-time video segmentation. Okay.
Yeah, I don't care what he says it's called. I'll just say GIF.
Yeah.
Unless he wants to pay me. We've mentioned, we are open for sponsorship and bribes.
That's right, on a periodic, regular basis.
Yes.
Yeah. Next one is one of the two items that John thinks we're going to have a disagreement with, and I think we might, based on our discussion before I started the recording this. Anyway, so 9to5 Mac reports that, KGI, Ming-Chi Kuo, who's, you know, kind of well-known for doing supply-side analysis, and then predicting what Apple's going to release. And Ming-Chi Kuo says that a new lower-cost MacBook Air is coming. And my prediction is that this low cost is probably going to come at the cost of losing ports. John doesn't care. And I want to know why.
Okay.
I care.
All right. I will freely admit, I do not own any device that has been the victim of the recent port destruction that Apple has done. My MacBook Pro is 2015. It's still got a ton of ports.
Yep.
But here's what I've brought up in the past, and here's why I think that losing ports in a random weird way may actually be a good thing.
Okay.
So we've mentioned before.
No, I'm kidding.
We've mentioned before that losing ports is not really a big deal if you have an office at home or an office anywhere, because anyone who does take a device back and forth for years now has probably wanted to have a docking station of some sort. Okay. Because even devices like my Surface Pro 4, I have Surface docks at my desk at work because I don't want to have to plug in 100 things and unplug it 100 different things. I want to just plug in one thing and go with it. So does that in your opinion, is that something that we should be kind of pushing for a use scenario to be able to just dock with one thing and then undock with one thing?
Well, it makes sense if you have this office at home, but one of the things the article points out is that MacBook Air is very popular amongst college students. And having bought my daughter two in the last 5 years, I would attest to that. And
okay.
She doesn't have a she doesn't have an office at home and an office somewhere else. She has a MacBook Air.
That is true. So this now brings me to my next point.
Okay.
You've played right into my hand. I know. As a person who teaches human factors engineering very often and cares about ergonomics, there is no good mobile workspace setup at all. I mean, you see people in coffee shops, and I see them around campus where they've got a computer, and then they've got 100 different things plugged into it, and power coming. It's kind of a mess, and you can't easily set up in the library or set up other places. In fact, one of the problems that college campuses have very frequently is that students will get all set up in the library, and then they will run to the bathroom or run to get a cup of coffee, and they come back, and their computer's gone.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even though it took them 5-10 minutes to get all set up and the way they wanted to go, it took 1 second to grab the laptop and run with it.
Right, and Apple removed the Kensington lock feature.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what I am hoping is that with this move to fewer ports, because this is something that we're going to see across the board. Apple's doing it now, but as we've seen countless times before, when Apple starts, others follow. With things like the headphone jack and optical drives and floppies. We talked about that last week.
Yep, we did.
What I want to see is someone come up with a really good mobile workspace setup. Perhaps it's a bag, a laptop sleeve that when you open it up, it's got a built-in battery, it's got it's got USB ports, it's got everything so that when you are a student or you're a mobile worker, you can open up basically your laptop and alongside is everything you need and you're up and running in a couple of seconds and you're back in your bag within a couple of seconds.
Mm.
And it's extensible. You can add things to it. You can take things out of it. Basically, it's the – if you remember back in the first era of smartphones, we had these devices that were kind of build-your-own smartphone thing. Where, do you want a bigger battery? Do you want a better camera? And all the there were cases that you'd slide parts in and out of. And I still think there's a market for that, but it would almost be the pure extensibility. You set up your mobile workstation exactly as you want, and it goes up and down in a couple of seconds versus a couple of minutes of setting up. Because that's not – a couple of minutes is not an optimal thing either. It's nice to have all the ports, but it means you're spending a lot of time plugging things into them.
Well – I have a different viewpoint on it. So, first, I agree with the scenario you presented. Those are, no disagreements there. But there are some things that just don't make sense to remove. So, for example, for some people, for some small number of people, one that I'm sure you would argue with and a lot of other people would is the SD card slot, which disappeared, in the last MacBook Air update, I think, a couple of years ago. Most people will say, well, nobody uses digital cameras anymore. They just shoot through your phone. And that's true. But there's still, not quite double digit, 5-10% of people probably still shoot with real digital cameras. And they miss those SD card slots. I know I do, which, basically can plug in something. But the other thing is, getting rid of the USB port means that something has to be a USB-C adapter. And those things are expensive. I mean, I bought a USB-C adapter with, a mini hub, I guess you call it, with an SD card slot and USB-A port. And it was like, I got it on sale for like $40, but I think normally it's $70 or $80. So it's pretty expensive. So there are still things we need. And even on rare occasions, plugging in an optical drive. Again, I don't have a USB-C optical drive, so you're out of luck if they remove that. And we don't know if any of this is true. We don't know if Apple's actually going to reduce price by removing ports, but I'm almost 100% certain that that's one of the ways they're probably going to use a cheaper case, maybe a lower resolution screen, Get rid of that stupid... Well, actually, the MacBook Air never had that touch bar, whatever it's called. So that's not an issue. But yeah, I guess I can see your point where, you know...
Fast, I mean, we're not there. So. We're not there yet at all.
No.
But I, you know, I know how much easier it is when I can just sit down, plug in a docking station compared to working in a mobile environment. But I do have to work in a mobile environment sometimes. Some days I am moving around, and I think this is just a real pain when – and you see it with people who are, oh, do you have a charger? I need to plug in. Okay, where's the nearest outlet? And, you know, okay, plug in this USB device, plug in this keyboard, plug in – it just – it's sort of a weird scenario. So I'm not saying that we're ready yet, but Apple has this annoying habit of making us move to be ready much quicker than we wanted to. And I kind of wonder if they hadn't pulled out floppy drives and optical drives, if you would still see those things prevalent. And I know that in my own use, I use an optical drive now about once every 2 months, 3 months. I have to plug in an external optical drive. I use SD cards about once every 2 or 3 months, and I actually have an external camera that uses SD card, but most of the time I actually transfer the pictures from that to my iPhone or my iPad, and I use the little SD dongle that connects to that. So. Right.
You know, I'll say one thing, though, about, you know, plugging in as your mobile is one of the things that I should see less and less, but I'm not sure I am actually seeing less and less, is people plugging into wall outlets for power. And that's because the battery technology has improved so much in the last couple of years that you can pretty much go, maybe not all day, but a good chunk of the day, depending how you're using your notebook, without plugging in. And so I don't see as many people plugging in. I still do see some people plugging in, and I wonder how they're using their notebook to require that. Now, that said, the Surface Pro 4, I used that a couple hours and you need to plug in. So if you are working without a charger, by lunchtime, you got to plug in. I mean, I know that for a fact on mine. Mm-hmm. The other thing, you know, and I'm sitting on the MacBook Air that I bought for my daughter when she became a freshman in college right now, and I'm looking at the battery health on it. And it's got about 88% of its capacity compared to its original capacity. So its original capacity was 7,150 milliamps per hour. And right now it's at current maximum 6,300 milliamps per hour. So milliampere. So, you know, it's lost 12% of its charge capacity in 4.7 years, which is not bad. So, you know, over time, people will need to charge more frequently because your battery capacity simply goes down over time. Maybe that's what I'm seeing. People with older notebooks plugging in, people with newer notebooks at, you know, full capacity, 100% or near 100% capacity, not so much.
I will say, though, that the MacBook Air that I had, the battery capacity, like the battery in that thing just was never up to snuff.
Really? Which MacBook Air did you use?
The 2000, the one you referred to as the first good one.
2010.
2011. I bought mine early 2011. So
yeah, so that one was a 10-inch or 11-inch display. It was it had a very small battery. I can't remember what it is. I should power mine up and go check. The one I'm using right now is a 13-inch and has a physically larger battery. And so it's not too bad. Even today, you know, it's almost 5 years old now. It's 4.7 years old, according to the battery health meter. Even today, it'll run pretty well on battery without needing to be charged. Although, I think I am getting a warning that it wants to... No, I'm not getting a warning. I am getting a warning on my old MacBook Air that its battery essentially needs to be replaced, but I never use it mobile anymore anyway. I always plug that one in. That one's, 8 years old now? Nearly 8 years old. Yeah. Okay. And, this is going to be a really fast podcast. the last one is not so much a technology as about a technology company called Apple. And Gizmodo has an article about 911 calls from Apple Park because employees are walking into the glass walls.
So there are a few angles that people can take with this.
Yeah.
One is purely Darwinism. Walking into glass is a bad idea.
Yep.
Distraction could be another piece of this.
That's my theory.
It could also be that the glass is just so beautiful that we would expect out of Apple, that people are in awe of its beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some of them want to merge with it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure what to take of this. I don't particularly like the solutions that anyone's come up with. I don't particularly like the solution of putting stickers on it.
Hey, we should do that. We should put Apple stickers.
Yeah, because that just sort of destroys the whole point of it. Pretty much anything you do to make it more visible destroys the whole point of having glass that clear and that large. My solution, probably as a human factors person, would be to take a page out of highway safety and put some rumble strips down so that as you start to walk toward the glass, you physically feel feedback in your feet going, ooh, maybe I shouldn't go that way.
You know, John, I never thought of that, and that is actually a very good idea.
Because that could be done, aesthetically very pleasing. It wouldn't have to look different. It's sort of taking a page off of the train platform book, you know, put the little raised bumps down so that people realize there's glass coming up. That's the only thing, but I hate the sticker idea. The stickers just sound stupid.
Well, except for Apple stickers. Come on.
But then what are you going to do? You got to put it at all eye levels? And if someone is truly distracted, they're not going to even see the sticker.
Well,
so,
then,
rumble
then,
strips.
Well, okay, then what we're going to need are modified Apple stickers that are 3D, kind of shaped as a small cone, right? And they're reflective at all angles, so it will be good for various heights. You put it at, say, 5 feet, right? So if you're less than 5 feet, like a child visiting campus with a parent, perhaps, you'll see it, from the downward reflection of this conical apple. And if you are taller than 5 feet, as most adults are, then you will see it from above. So, you know, it'd be good. And if you're 7 feet tall, you may be out of your visual field, but that's another problem.
So Apple loves ergonomic and very sleek things. So the rumble strips are the simple solution.
Right.
But if you want to go way more complex, over-engineered, and unnecessary, why don't we just build in RFID sensors that trigger a small electric shock in an employee's ID badge that basically, as you get closer to the window, you start to feel this little buzzing sensation, and it physically guides you away through aversive conditioning away from the windows.
Well, you know, based on the assumption that all Apple IDs should have an Apple Watch, we could build it into the watch.
That's definitely easier to do, but I said we want it over-engineered and complicated. So we're going to build the Apple Shock Badge that uses Taptic, a.k.a. beat-em-up technology, to slowly push you back onto the straight and narrow away from the beautiful windows.
Right. So I think continuing on my Apple product-based idea is, put it in a watch, require all employees to wear both a watch and the AirPods, and as as your head's down looking at your phone, not paying attention to where you're walking, it will not only buzz your hand, your whatever wrist you have your watch on, but it'll also speak into your AirPods saying, hey, heads up, heads up.
That is way too practical. What I would like to do is start playing Annie Lennox's Walking on Broken Glass. That's a good, just a little bit of the main refrain of that, maybe in MIDI form, and it triggers something in the brain's patterns of, I better stay away.
Yeah, and it's something I've been waiting to say the whole podcast. People who live in glass houses should not run into them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a bad idea. We were going to say something about millennials, but as I mentioned to John, when I read the transcripts of the three people who ran, all male, by the way, of the three people who ran into the glass walls at Apple Park, one was middle-aged, so it's not a millennial joke. The other thing I think John alluded to that we might have a little disagreement on. So one was described as a middle-aged man, which at Apple might be 30 years old. So
that might be the case. That's very true. And as I told Todd, I try my hardest these days not to blame millennials because they get blamed for everything else.
Now, are you a millennial, John, or are you just outside of that range?
You know, I am somewhere in the range of between Gen X and Millennial.
Oh, okay.
In fact, BuzzFeed this week had this insightful article, as all BuzzFeed articles are,
yeah,
about what they called Xennials. X-E. and I took the little quiz, and I don't quite agree that I am an Xennial. Because I actually identify a lot more with pop culture of the 80s. Right. And would consider myself a child of the 80s and not of the 90s. The 90s is why I spent a lot of, you know, years kind of growing up as a teenager and young adult, but I don't really consider myself a child of the 90s. So I think that's where it is. If you consider yourself a child of the 80s, you're Gen X. If you consider yourself a child of the 90s, you're a millennial. And I would say I'm probably the tail end of Gen X.
Yeah. Well, this is not official, but according to Pew Research, I think many people have some respect for in their opinions. Pew Research, in a recent Fact Tank article, titled, let me see, Defining Generations Where Millennials End and Post-Millennials Begin, they define, or this is just Pew Research, you know, it's not official as they say, but close as they come. They say, and let me see if I can find this now, for Pew Research is point of view, they will use anyone. Millennials are defined as anyone born between 1981 and 1996 exclusively. Inclusively. So 1981, 1996 are people who are 22 to 37 years old this year are considered a millennial.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's as good as any. You know, and the other thing they say, by the way, so what comes after millennials? People born after 1996? And the answer is none of the people born after 1996. Let's see, is this true? 1996, 2006, 2006. Anyway, they're saying that they basically haven't been long enough to designate them in anything, I think. So they haven't really defined them, you know, with a name. So basically, mm-hmm, it's the silent generation, 1928, 1945. Baby boomers, 1946, 1964. Gen X, 1965 to 1980, and Millennials, 1981 to 1996. There we go. Anything else, John? That's all I got.
I think that's all I got. I've been staying busy on a new sort of secret venture that I will announce in future weeks.
All
but
right,
other than
good.
That, yeah, I'll just tease it and, you know, life has been pretty good. We're coming up into spring. Spring's a nice season.
Yeah.
And I'm getting excited to start seeing the rumors about iOS, next versions of iOS, next versions of Android. Should hopefully be a fun spring.
Yeah. Android P for peanut butter. I don't know what they're going to call it. Not much going on this end, as I said. It's not much of a tech news week, in my opinion. Last week's Mobile World Congress, or was that the week before? I forget. But meh, as we said last week. Yeah, I guess that's it. Kind of a short-ish podcast this week. But some are, some aren't.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we will talk to you next time. We'll probably be recording right around when daylight saving starts, which affects John, but not me. And John, not much, from what he told me. It doesn't really bother him as much as some people. So we'll talk to you next time.